Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the director of the Royal Ballet, Dame Monica Mason. She's been called the woman who rescued the Royal. She could equally be called the woman who dedicated her life to Covent Garden. In a few months, she will take her final curtain call, 54 years after winning her place in the Corps de Ballet. She has shared a stage with Margot Fonteyn and Rudolf Nureyev and was mentored by Kenneth MacMillan. Amid the passions, drama and torment of striving for artistic perfection, one thing has remained constant. She says, "People around me thought of leaving the company because they were unhappy, but I didn't. I thought this is the best company in the world. I couldn't imagine I could be happier anywhere else." So, Monica Mason, planning seasons, looking ahead to tours, securing funding, all that's been your meat and drink over the past few years. Now, of course, you're just a few months from stepping down as director. Are you taking time to look back at this extraordinary, enduring relationship that you've had with the Royal Ballet?
Well, you know, I'm finding that as people are looking back over my 54 years with the Royal Ballet, it's meant that I am reflecting. But of course, in looking back, one rediscovers joys and fears and all sorts, all the things that have gone to make one's life what it's been.
And when you do step down, it's in the summer, is it in July?
Yes, in July, yes.
Will you go back and watch performances, do you think?
Well, I've been invited to come back in and work with the company on certain Macmillan works, and so I'm thrilled that I shall be able to do that, because I think it would be very hard if I was just going to completely lose touch with everybody. I don't think I could bear that, actually. I think I'd have to go back in and have a cup of tea and sit in the office and keep a chair warm, really. I can't imagine cutting the ties completely.
Do you think that might be quite difficult for the new director to have you there? Because at least they might be intimidated by your record, I would imagine.
I think that one of the things that I really would be determined not to do would be to get in the new director's hair. I couldn't bear it if I thought that behind closed doors somebody was saying, "She's here again, you know." So I shall keep my distance and only go in when I'm asked.
You yourself were a principal dancer for a time. What does it take to be a principal dancer?
Well, I think that it takes a huge amount of work, absolute dedication, and that you don't achieve it easily. But, you know, the joy of dance, which, again, one doesn't really quite understand why we long to do this punishing thing, really, more than compensates.
Let's have some music, Monica Mason. Tell me about the first piece we're going to hear today. What is it and why have you chosen it?
Well, I think Billie Holiday is one of those stars, that indescribable stars. Her voice, for me, describes the pain and the joys in her life. And I think it touches all of us.
All of me, why not take all of me? Can't you see I'm no good without you? Take my lips, I want to lose them. Take my...
That was Billie Holiday and All of Me. So, Monica Mason, there are around 40 dancers in the Corps de Ballet, among them, of course, some of the youngest dancers, as young as 15 at times. I've read that you have a sort of motherly relationship with them. Would that be fair?
Well, I suppose it's partly to do with when I stopped dancing, I started to do coaching of injured dancers. It came out of having had a difficult injury myself at one stage, and you can become very scared and you lose your confidence. you see other people dancing your roles, and you feel you're losing a part of yourself. And so I think that when I started to coach dancers, I sort of felt I was on the same wavelength.
How long were you yourself out of action for?
I was off the stage for 9 months. I think that I had some really wonderful friends in the company. I'd put on weight. I didn't like what I saw in the mirror, so I simply didn't look, actually, for a while. And I remember one day, Michael Soames took my hand and he said, "You're ready now to do the step that you did that caused your injury." And I said, I'm not sure I can do that. And he said, "Yes, you can. Come on." And he stood in front of me, and in fact, he held both my hands. And I slid my foot across the floor, gently to start with, and then a little more. And then he said, "And now tomorrow we're going to do it even more strongly." And that got me back.
The uncompromising physical aesthetic of classical dance, of course, demands that dancers are in the best possible shape, meaning they are extremely slim. I mean, you presumably throughout the years have dealt with young dancers who insist on, you know, an apple for lunch and two crackers for breakfast and a lot of water and not much else.
You know, we use a nutritionist for advice for them because they have to understand that food is fuel and what they put into their bodies is extremely important. And so I think that because they have such high aspirations, sometimes they are prepared to go to great lengths to achieve the image that they want in the mirror. But it can be very damaging.
I don't know if you've seen, have you seen the movie Black Swan?
Do you know, I didn't. I especially didn't go because somebody told me not to.
I don't think you would have enjoyed it.
No, from the sound of it, I don't think I would have.
Well, of course, it was an overblown Hollywood interpretation. But one of the points that was made in the movie, that there were these beautiful young women who, of course, couldn't even let a morsel of cake pass their lips without running to the toilet to throw up. I mean, is that something that are you conscious of in the ballet world? Is it something that you think you have to just accept as part of the scene?
No, I think that was a very extreme view. I think that, by and large, the dancers in the Royal Ballet, who are the ones that I know best, know how to take care of themselves.
Let's have some more music, Monica. What's next?
Well, of course, Swan Lake is such a huge part of a classical ballet company's repertoire. And when you're dancing in the corps de ballet, or if you're dancing the lead, there's something about standing on the stage behind those curtains and hearing the orchestra begin this fabulous overture. It is simply so inspiring, and needs to be, because this is not an easy ballet to dance.
The Russian State Symphony Orchestra playing the overture to Swan Lake by Tchaikovsky, conducted by Dmitry Yablonsky. You were giving me a little window on that backstage world, and I was asking you during the music if there's ever been a time when you have been almost overwhelmed by the responsibility of dance. And you started to tell me about, well, it must have been 1963, and it would have been the 22nd of November. Tell me what happened.
We were just about to start a performance, and the news of the shooting of President Kennedy came through. And somebody went in front of the curtains and told the public. I mean, we were absolutely struck dumb. The idea that this could have happened was completely overwhelming. And then, of course, we had to dance. But it was a question absolutely of putting the lid on that box with all those emotions and summoning up your courage, really, just to get on and dance.
Let's travel then a little further back. We're going back to the early 1940s. It's South Africa, and you are born to a British mother, South African father. Your father 12 years older than your mother. How did your parents meet?
Actually, my mother was born in South Africa.
And
she and my father met at work. My father was an accountant. My mother was a secretary. And he was 12 years older than her, very handsome, and a very, very lovely man.
And did your mother then have British parents? Is that where I'm getting that
yes.
from? Yes. Right. And I'm imagining at that time in South Africa, your home was well populated by staff. How did they treat you and how did you treat them?
Well, you know, it wasn't actually. We had a woman who came to help my mother with the washing. And then we had a man in the house who did a lot of cleaning. And he helped my mother cook the evening meal. But we were not waited on hand and foot. My mother didn't believe in it. And so there was a lot of respect shown to the people who worked for us.
And your parents were a very social couple, were they? They had
they were very social, yes. They had lots of friends, and I remember parties, and I always used to creep out and come down the stairs. I loved watching people dance, and I loved seeing them ballroom dancing.
Let's have some more music. We're on the third disc of the day, Monica Mason. What are we going to hear?
We're going to hear Richard Tauber singing You Are My Heart's Delight, because I have a very vivid memory of my grandmother and a wind-up gramophone, and she would say to me, let's go and sit down and listen to my favourite. And I knew exactly which it was. I would wind the gramophone up, put this record on, and then see her put her head back on the chair and shut her eyes, and her face had an expression of absolute bliss.
You are my heart's delight, and where you are, I long. My darkness bright, when like a star you shine on me.
That was Richard Tauber, and You Are My Heart's Delight. Memories there of your grandmother leaning back in the chair and just soaking up that beautiful piece of music, Monica Mason. Your father died then when you were just 13. Can you tell me what happened?
Well, I think he must have known something wasn't right, and by the time he went to see a specialist, it was realised that he had something seriously wrong. Of course, my sister and I were not told anything, and he drove me to school on the Monday morning and said, I'm driving myself on into hospital. And in fact, it was the last conversation I had with him, because children weren't allowed into the particular hospital that he was in. And I remember he came out on a balcony and waved to us, and we were on the other side of the road. I never saw him again. He died on the Saturday. He had cancer, and it was far too advanced for them to do anything. So he died in 5 days.
I'm thinking of this very tender and small unit then of you. Your mother then would just have been in her early 30s. She was a
yes,
very young woman.
Yes.
Your sister, you've mentioned, and you were the eldest of
yes.
the two. Did your mother lean on you for support?
Do you know, she was extraordinary. I remember that on the night of his death, the doctor came round to the house and gave her, I suppose, a sleeping pill. And he said, I've given your mother something to help her to sleep. I think it would be wonderful if you could sleep in the room with her. They had two single beds pushed together, because in South Africa you tended not to have double beds because of the heat. And I think my mother slept in my father's bed and I slept in hers. And the doctor had said to me, you must be very brave for her. And looking back, of course, I think, gosh, that was quite something to say to a 13-year-old. And I just thought, I will do that. I will try to be brave for her. And in the night, I could hear her talking. And she spoke very clearly. I could hear her talking to my father. She wanted to know why he'd gone so quickly. And she told him what a wonderful life they'd had together. And I lay there in the dark listening to this, and I thought, I must be brave, I must be brave. And of course then I heard her crying. I think I've cried for years following that.
Yes.
I can still cry. At the time, I didn't.
And I'm sure you weren't crying for yourself, but I'm wondering if in a way that was the end of your childhood. There you were at 13, suddenly faced with the harshest reality that any of us have to bear.
Well, I think what I noticed particularly was when I went back to school, I remember feeling incredibly different suddenly.
Yeah.
All my friends talked about their parents, and now I couldn't talk about my father. And I just was so aware of feeling rather isolated.
And where was dance in this? You obviously were dancing at that age. And
well, dance was really, I think, probably quite a lifeline. Although, interestingly, just not long before my father had died, I had said to him one Sunday morning, we were sitting together, and I said to him, you know, I think I want to be a professional dancer. And he said, well, you know, I don't think that's perhaps quite sensible because there's no professional company here in South Africa. And I thought then, well, I didn't want to upset him in any way, and I just thought, this will keep, we'll talk about this another time. And of course we never did.
Let's have some music, Monica. What are we going to hear? We're on
well,
the fourth piece.
I've chosen Charlie Kunz and the Harry Lime theme because my father loved piano music. And I remember one day, again, a very clear memory of him putting this record on and him saying, would you like to learn to foxtrot? And so with that, I stood on his feet and we danced around the sitting room.
Charlie Kunz playing the Harry Lime theme. And so after your father died, Monica Mason, your mother was persuaded to move to England. Tell me about your first memories of arriving in England.
We arrived on Friday the 13th of July, 1956. It was a very rainy, chilly day. And of course the ship docked in Southampton and we travelled up to London on a train. And it was so exciting. I think I spent the entire journey looking out of the window, except for noticing that the person who'd come to meet us at the ship was the man who became my stepfather. And he was a business associate of my father's. I noticed that he looked at my mother in a way that indicated his feelings were not dispassionate.
How long was it before they married?
Oh, they married. We arrived in the July and they married at the end of October.
Ah, so it was...
It was very fast. I think she probably liked him a lot and grew to love him. But I think she realised that he was going to be such a good friend and that she must have been frightened by the idea of looking after my sister and myself alone in London. But he was a wonderful support, a tremendous friend.
And let's not forget that this was a London of smog and, you know, a bombed-out city. I mean, London would still, in parts, have been in rubble, was it?
Absolutely. I mean, they were hard times and some things were still rationed. It couldn't have been more different from our life in South Africa. But, you know, I don't think I noticed the grey skies. All I knew was that I was able to dance every day.
So at the time that you joined the Royal Ballet, you were the youngest ever. Tell me about your audition. How did that go?
Well, you know, I failed my first audition for the ballet school, so I took another one and got in, and I went for a year. And during my year at the ballet school, I danced with the opera.
Maria Callas and Tita Gobbi, is that right? You danced while they were singing?
Yes, I did.
And what were they like?
Yes. Well, of course, we had to go up the stairs behind her dressing room to reach the floor where we were changing. And we had to tiptoe up the stairs and we weren't allowed to speak.
Who told you that?
Her dresser. Because her dresser was like on guard outside the dressing room.
And did you ever see Madame at close quarters?
Oh, yes. Fabulous face. Those enormous eyes. Very, very strong. And she was always surrounded by people. She was escorted to the stage and escorted back to her dressing room. And, well, I suppose, you know, you're in an opera house, so there are stars around. She was a big one.
And Margot Fonteyn, it has to be said, a creature of such grace, perfection and beauty that it would be difficult to imagine anybody not being intimidated by her. Did you encounter her at all?
I used to stand next to her on the bar. And I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. The outline of her neck and shoulders and the way she held her arm. I mean, I can even see the shape of her fingernails now, if I think about it. She was the most incredible role model. But she was also so human, and she giggled so contagiously.
Very difficult to imagine that, really. I find that astonishing.
No, she loved life.
Let's have some more music then, Monica. What's next?
Well, my father was born in Natal, near a town called Ladysmith. And as a child, my family used to go down to our cousins. And, of course, we were surrounded by Zulus. And I was so amazed by the harmony of their voices when they sang. My father could speak Zulu. And this piece of music, when it first came out, I remember thinking, oh, this is me. And so this is Paul Simon and the Ladysmith Black Mambazo.
She's a rich girl, she don't try to hide it. Diamonds on the soles of her shoes. He's a poor boy, empty as a pocket. Empty as a pocket with nothing to lose.
Paul Simon and Ladysmith Black Mambazo and Diamonds on the Soles of Her Shoes. In the introduction, Monica Mason, I described Kenneth Macmillan as your mentor. He was, of course, the artistic director of the Royal Ballet through the 70s. How did you meet?
Well, I met him really within, I think, the first 2 weeks of being in the company. So I was only 16 and he was, I think, 12 years older than me.
Tell me about the night. You say that night I was showing off like hell and I was pretty sure Kenneth was watching me.
Oh, that was somebody's housewarming party.
Yes.
And I loved going mad at parties. It didn't require any drink to get me to go mad. And I knew Kenneth was watching.
And so you're a bit of an extrovert then, are you?
Oh, yes. I was.
Not anymore?
Oh, I suppose I control it because I can't be seen to be doing that as a director.
And so the extroversion, did it come from having a physical confidence, of knowing that you could command a room with your presence?
You know, I always loved being physical. I loved performing. But I never felt I was wonderful at it. I just knew I got such pleasure out of if somebody said, dance, I would do it.
Do you still dance?
Oh, if I get the chance, yes.
Yes, dance at parties and
so on. No, not so much at parties, but I do dance in the kitchen a lot.
Your own private performance. Mm. Well, in the case of Kenneth Macmillan, it was Be Careful What You Wish For, because he made a new ballet for you to play the lead in. It was a new version of Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring, in which your character literally dances herself to death in the final scene. Tremendous physical hard work. Tell me about it.
Well, he called me across the room and he said, I've been given permission to make a new ballet and I want you to dance the lead. I was 20. I didn't know what he was talking about.
Just to be clear, were you still part of the corps de ballet at that point?
Yes, I was. I was in the corps de ballet. But he said, this is not going to be classical ballet at all. I'm going to invent a different way of moving. It was intriguing because the pianist, he had broken down the score into dancers' counts. And so we counted the final sacrificial dance that she does right at the end of the piece into this sort of incredible telephone number lists of numbers, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. You just rattle these numbers off. And I used to go home every night, play the music, listen to it on the disc, and count the counts and remind myself of the steps.
As you say, you were just 20, and the reviews for your performance were phenomenal. Did you devour them all up and think, yep, I've arrived?
Well, you know, there's also that moment when you think, was that me? Did I do that? And because it was designed on me, it was made on me, you know, it fits like the most wonderful clothes made for you. Kenneth, I think, when he'd watched me at that party, would have known, because he was a genius, that he could push me to an incredible limit. And there's something rather wonderful or mad to think that you could die dancing. I used to think that. What a wonderful way to go.
Time for some music then, Monica. What are we going to hear?
Well, entirely appropriately, we're going to hear the final dance of the Rite of Spring. And this is where one hopes to convince everybody that you're completely dead at the end of it.
The Sacrificial Dance from the Rite of Spring by Stravinsky, played by the Concertgebouw Orchestra of Amsterdam, conducted by Colin Davis. Indeed, Monica Mason, he conducted that first performance.
Yes, he did.
Can you, as you're listening to that, can you recall every single step?
Yes. Yes, I think I probably have to do it on the beach on my desert island.
Kenneth MacMillan then ended up creating, I think it was 5 roles especially for you in total. You were at Covent Garden the night he died.
Yes.
Did you have any inkling that all was not well?
Oh, yes, because I was sitting by his side and I could tell that some days he was exhausted. His wife, Deborah, said to me, you know, Kenneth is seriously ill. He could die at any moment. That terrified me. And his death that night, it was the opening performance of Marling. Even at the beginning of the evening, he said, I'm not feeling very good. And when we came to the second interval, Anthony Dowell, who was the director, and Deborah, his wife and I, were looking for him and we couldn't find him anywhere. Deborah said to me, Monica, go and watch the rest of the evening. And 2/3 of the way through the last act, somebody tapped me on the shoulder and I knew immediately that something terrible must have happened.
So your dancing days finished then. You stayed with the company as assistant to the director. You said at the time, this is interesting, you set out to be the best assistant there could be. You saw that as your role. You weren't sort of gunning for the top job at that point.
I was never gunning for the top job. I never for a moment saw myself as a director of a
company.
Why
not?
Well, I think because if you've worked in a company under Ninette de Valois, Frederick Ashton and Kenneth MacMillan...
Yes, I get where you're going with
you
that.
You wouldn't.
Yes.
And so, you know, I have hung their portraits in my office as a constant reminder of the responsibilities that I carry.
In a way, the job sort of fell into your lap. As you say, it wasn't one that you were gunning for. How surprised were you to find it there?
Well, because I was assistant director, it felt natural to be asked to look after the company. And after about 6 weeks, I discovered that I really loved it. But because everybody was so wonderful to me and everybody was so for me. You know, it sort of happened almost without me being aware that it was happening. And the next thing I was appointed. And so then I thought, now I've got to go for this.
You were married for many years to another dancer. I can only imagine that in a household like that, you are living and breathing dance.
Well, my husband had stopped being a dancer by the time we married.
Right.
He had a serious injury and he went to work in the music business.
Ah, right. You didn't have children. Is that because dance was taking up a lot of your life at the time?
Do you know, I don't quite know why I didn't get pregnant, but it didn't happen.
Let's have some music, Monica. Our seventh of the day.
Well, my husband was an amazing musician, as well as having been a dancer. And he used to take his guitar with him on tour. And so I used to find myself sitting in his room while he played his guitar for hours. And I grew to love the music, and I grew to love him. So this, of course, has a very special place in my heart.
Andrés Segovia playing the prelude number 1 in E minor by Heitor Villa-Lobos. That was dedicated to your former husband, Monica Mason. I'm wondering about this life of dedication, in fact. You have been dedicated to the ballet, and yet when you retire next year, you know, the ballet finds someone else to take your role as director. What do you find? What takes its place?
It's going to be so difficult, I think, to imagine. I can't really plan it because it's outside of my experience. Because, of course, I've never been anywhere else. I don't know anything else.
Yes.
But I have never stopped thinking about my very first days with the Royal Ballet and what that meant to me, which is why I really never wanted to go anywhere else. And it's remained the same to this day. The most demanding aspect, really, is the amount of energy needed. And I think, been blessed with lots of energy. So I was only too happy to give it to my profession.
You wouldn't think now, I wonder. I mean, you seem a very vigorous person, full of a lot still to give. You say you quite like the taste of power once you were given it. You wouldn't think about going to run something else.
Well, it hasn't arisen yet, but, do you know, I'm quite open to suggestions. But of course, I can tell that I don't have as much energy as I had when I was a young dancer.
Well, it's all relative, Monica.
It is, yes.
You'll be dancing to the Stravinsky, as we know, on the island. What else will you do on the island? Will you occupy yourself?
I'll do some gardening.
Right.
It won't be easy. As long as it's not too cold or not too desolate, it might be okay.
I think you'll make a good fist of it. Let's hear your final piece of music then.
Well, my final piece of music has to be The Song of the Earth. This ballet by Kenneth MacMillan, many people feel, is perhaps his greatest achievement. It's a great piece of choreography and just meant so much to me to be in this ballet.
The ending of Der Abschied, The Farewell, from The Song of the Earth by Mahler, sung by Christa Ludwig and Fritz Wunderlich, with the Philharmonia and New Philharmonia orchestras, conducted by Otto Klemperer. So we come to the moment, Monica, when I shall give you the books. You get the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare. And what are you going to take along?
Well, I would like a specially put together omnibus of everything by David Attenborough. I just think he's completely wonderful, and he's taught us all so much about the world we live in.
Right. One great big bound volume, then, is yours, and a luxury too.
Well, now, I'm probably not allowed to have all sorts of things. I wondered perhaps, in the end, to be practical, I'd need a torch, because it's going to be very dark on this island. And I remember as a child being very frightened of the dark. African nights are very black, and although wonderfully starry, and I think I'll need a torch.
Right, we shall give you that. And if you had to save just one disc from the waves, which one of the eight would you pick?
Oh, it would have to be The Song of the Earth.
Dame Monica Mason, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island discs.
Thank you so much, Kirsty.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.